up, y'all, and welcome back to Found Bites, a game review series. My name is Brian, and I'll be your host. If you don't know about us, we're all about testing out and finding small, high-quality video games. This is a podcast that aims to respect your time and money as a gamer and a consumer by sifting through storefronts and sales to find those gems that may be worth your precious resources. If you're interested in reaching out or helping out, check out the links in the description of each episode to access our email, Twitter, website, and YouTube channel. But enough about the show, let's get into our next game. Infernax is the game for this week's episode. Infernax is a 2D action dungeon crawler, and I'm hesitant to brand it as a Metroidvania because this game compares a lot to the 2D Castlevania games, to Zelda 2, and of course some comparisons to some more modern releases like Blasphemous and Shovel Knight. The game was originally released in February of 2022 on PC, PS4, Xbox One, Series X and S, and Switch. The game was developed by Berserk Studio, and they're a Canadian studio, and they've developed a bunch of games. I looked on their website, nothing that I'd really heard of. But the game was published by The Arcade Crew, and they've published some games that I've heard about, some that we've talked about on our Tales and Sales episode, like the Vengeful Guardian Moonrider, Young Souls, as well as a game called The Last Spell that I've had on my watch list for a while that I might actually jump on in this newest sale. The game had free DLC that was released in April of 2023 called Do or Die, D-E-U-X, Do or Die. And it added two-player co-op, which is pretty cool. I have not tried it out, but it seems great. And I certainly love when small dev teams give out free DLC, show love to their fans. Definitely some good stuff there. And the game had physical releases. In January of 2022, there was a PS4 and Switch release from Limited Run Games, and they had a standard release and a collector's edition that had some extra goodies, and I believe that was just in the US. In the EU, I think Merge Games published it through Signature Edition, and they have a standard edition on PS4 and Switch, and I think that edition is actually available through all retailers. I think it might be on Walmart and places like that. The game launched with an MSRP of $19.99, and those physical editions, I think the standard editions for both Signature and for Limited Run Games were $35, and that collector's edition for Limited Run was sold for $65. Runtime of the game, if you're just playing through the story, not doing any of the side quests, the main story, you could probably get through in about 5 hours, but there is a ton of extra content, side quests, a lot of hidden stuff that will talk about. Could definitely put you over 10, maybe even over 15 hours. And the game does have a platinum trophy for our PlayStation listeners. I think it requires that you beat the game multiple times because there are different endings. And me, I got this for sale for $12.39 on PS4. I had actually been watching it for a while, waiting for a nice sale. And so far, I've put in probably over 8 hours. I beat the game. I got a particular ending. I'm not sure if I want to go back. I don't think I'm going to go for the platinum trophy, but I definitely put a lot of hours in on some side stuff. And the game was recommended to me by a Watch Out for Fireballs episode. Those are the same guys, Gary and Cole, that do Bonfireside Chats over at DougFeed.tv. Big fan of Watch Out for Fireballs. I actually didn't listen to the episode, but I saw that they had put it as one of theirs. I did download it, but I haven't listened to it yet. So I kind of wanted to dive into the game first and potentially do an episode on it. And here we are. All right, let's talk gameplay for Infernax. So this is an NES-era 2D action-adventure game, and it just bleeds Castlevania, Zelda 2, games in those genres. It really just is kind of a love letter to those games. But let's go through some of the basics here. So it's a 2D game. You're moving left to right. You can jump. You can do a melee attack. And there is some specific timing with the jump and the melee attack, depending on how high something is. If you can time it to hit it at the apex of your jump or something like that. It's very responsive and it's very precise. And that's really good for a game that I think looks like it has the feel of an NES game, but really does have that modern precision. But I also think people who were fans of those NES era games would also argue that they had quite a high level of precision regardless. Something else you can do is crouch. All you can do is press down and your character will crouch lower, and you can do that and attack. So there are some enemies that are lower to the ground and you can attack them, or you can attack regular enemies at their feet. But the big reason for the crouching is actually that your character passively holds a shield and blocks most things, most projectiles, not all of them. But if you're just standing, it doesn't cover your feet. So if something shoots like a spear at your feet, and enemies will do that. I actually found this by accident. I was just crouching because I was trying to hit a lower level enemy and somebody threw a projectile at my feet and I happened to block it because my shield was down. And then you can also use or cycle through the different potions that you have, and you can use or cycle through the different spells that you have. And traversal in this game, so nothing really surprising in terms of just how you're progressing. It's like you're on a screen, and if you go off screen, you'll exit onto the next screen. This can happen left or right or up or down because there is some platforming here. And if you look at the map, again, I hate to use this term, but it is a Metroidvania style map. So if you go in a room, it'll kind of show you all the exits and where you can exit if there's an up or to the right at specific parts of the room. And just some platforming basics, like you can jump up on platforms. If you press down and jump, you go down through them. And there'll be some slight platforming challenges that will elevate in challenge, but basically you've got some things that you might already realize, like moving platforms. There are wheels that are spinning a certain way that you have to kind of jump on and move through. There are certain elevators, and a lot of what you're doing, you're going to be avoiding spikes. If you hit a spike, it'll kind of do damage, but the main things are going to be if there are pits that are endless or if there's water, your character can't swim. That's a little different because you actually die, and we'll talk about dying. And there'll be doors and doorways where you can go up to them and you press up and you'll go in a room or you'll go into another part of a building or something like that. Primarily, you'll see these doors or doorways in towns or in dungeons. And your map is very helpful, as in most Metroidvanias. What's really good is that they're colored differently. If it's just like the normal type of area that has enemies in it, or if it's a village or a town that is kind of safe, it'll be colored differently, and then it'll mark different save points as you access them for the first time. Progression in this game, it's going to be exploration based. It kind of feels like a mini open world, although it's very limited, but you can kind of explore at your leisure. Like I said, you'll go through towns, you'll go through enemy areas, and then you'll eventually get into dungeons. But the primary way that you're progressing through this game is through quests. And so you have main quests, and then you have side quests. Your main quests are really going to revolve around going in different dungeons. Some of the main quests are like, do these five things or something like that. And then there's a lot of side quests in this game. And you're going to find the majority of these by talking to NPCs. So anytime you get to a town, just talk to NPCs. I think there's at least 20, if not more, different side quests. But like I said, the main quests, they'll eventually get to the point where in just about any Zelda game, it's like you have to go to five dungeons and beat all the bosses in the dungeons. There are also hidden quests in this game, and they're kind of linked to this morality system. This is far more extensive than I realized as I was playing through. And I didn't really find out until kind of the end game, where like if you do certain tasks or in certain quests, you kind of have these binary choices sometimes. If you do all bad things or all good things, it kind of like puts you down a path. And it's very Skyrim, because I know that like in games like that, the Elder Scroll games, like if you go down a certain path, like you get approached with quests. If you're on the evil path or the good path or something like that. So there is a lot that you can do in the end game, but you have to have made all of the right decisions or all the wrong decisions. I actually did not get to a lot of this stuff, but I happened to read about it. Really interesting stuff there. And then anytime you do quests, you're going to get rewards, and pretty much your rewards are going to be gold and experience. And then as you're progressing through the game, you're going to run into enemies. Enemies are everywhere. Anytime you're at a place that is not a village, the potential for there to be enemies is always there. So let's talk about some of the different enemies. These are pretty basic. You've got your walkers, your runners back and forth. Some will be floating in like almost like a sine wave pattern, which can make the combat and platforming actually really interesting. And then you've got ones that jump, ones that spawn, floaters. Just all in all, the basic enemies, it's very Mega Man with their placement and their moveset and how they kind of get closer to you and annoy you. And then you'll see some more advanced enemies as you go forward, some that'll wield weapons, some that'll throw weapons or projectiles, ones that will intentionally crouch, which can be a kind of a pain, but like we talked about with the shield, you have to kind of be ready for that, and some that actually have shields themselves, so you have to wait for an opening. The bosses in this game are really good. They're interesting. I like some of their mechanics, and hitting them is kind of obvious. They have like specific weak spots. It'll look like an eye, and it might be on the top or in the middle, or you might have to wait for it to open or something like that. But in general, I would say like the hitboxes for enemies or them hitting you, the timing of when they strike and if you're going to get hit or not, if you get out of the way, or their melee range, I feel like they all seem very fair and very precise. Again, it's kind of like it feels like a modern game, but I also feel like fans of these older kind of 2D adventure action games would also say that a lot of those older games are very precise in sort of the placement and the hitboxes and things like that. When you kill enemies, they will go away, but if you go off screen, they will constantly respawn. So you can go back and forth if you're like farming for gold or things like that, but this can get annoying if you're going in a dungeon and you have to kind of backtrack. Enemies will always respawn in the room after you come back to the screen. And also, as you're progressing through the game, you will run into shops, and we'll talk about the different things you can buy, but these shops primarily are going to be found in towns, but you will find some that are outside of towns or on the outskirts, and you can kind of buy things there at shops at your leisure as long as you have gold. And let's talk about your character. So your character will have stats, will have health, mana. These are bars that you can see on the main screen at the top, and your character will also have sort of passive stats that aren't visually displayed. One is attack strength and one is defense. And anytime you get enough experience, you can go to any save point and you can upgrade one of three things: your health, your mana, or your attack power, meaning your strength. And the cost for experience for leveling these up is going to go up as you go to higher levels for each of them, but they all kind of stay at the same. So like the first one I think is like 500 and then it jumps to 1,000. So it depends on which one you want to level up, and you can kind of paste that at your choice. Other things you're going to do in this game: you will buy or find better weapons and armor. Really, there's only four possibilities, so you're kind of slowly progressing through. You start with the basic armor and the basic mace, and then you'll find the third best one, and then the second best one, and then the best one. Some of these require finding hidden quests. Some of these are just exploration that you'll find. You'll also find different attack or traversal skills that'll kind of act as keys. There is some light Metroidvania here. You're not specifically going to get a double jump, but you will get a skill that can propel you in certain directions that allow you to travel or get to places that you couldn't access before you had that skill. And then you also buy or find different spells. And the spells that you find are actually interesting. There's a nice variety. Some are for straight attack. Some are for buffing your character. Some are for healing them. And to use them, it will consume mana. So it'll say like, this will consume 2 MP or 3 MP or 4 MP. And then when you use it, it ticks down from that meter. Some of the spells will actually have upgraded versions, and these are linked to quests. So if you go and do a specific side quest, you might get a better version of a spell. And these are also linked to some of the morality things, because you can get like this spell or this spell depending on what choice you made in that moral instance. You can also buy potion bottles, and I think there are a limited number in the game, maybe like 4 or 5. I think it's 5. Once you buy potion bottles, that means that you can fill them with any potion, and where you would refill these are at inns. So inns, you can get either red, blue, or green potions. Not all of the inns have all of them, but they all do have the red one, and the red one is free to refill any amount of your potion bottles that you want. If you want the blue one, that's to refill your mana. I think that costs a little bit, and then the green is the elixir that fills both your health and mana, and I think that costs a little more. So you can kind of pick and choose how you want to stash your potions as you buy more bottles. And then you can also wind up buying extra lives. Now, these are permanent. When you buy an extra life, you have it permanently, and you can get 3 max in the game. And we'll talk about how the mechanic works with that in regards to dying. And let's get into pacing and accessibility. And so we just started talking about dying. So the way that the dying mechanic works is there are a couple different ways that you can die. Your health can go down to zero if you're in combat and you will die, or if you fall into an endless pit, or if you fall into water, which are ways that like you can't come back from. So if you die and you happen to have another life, what'll happen is it'll reset that screen and your life will tick down. And you just go back to where you entered that screen and you'll have max health and max mana. But if you don't have extra lives, you will die and it'll kind of be like a game over and you will have to return to the last time you saved. Now, this is interesting because if you pass a save point, you will reheal, but you have to save it manually in order to get respawn there if you die and you don't have any more lives. So my advice to you, and this is something that I ran into a couple times, especially early in the game, is to every time you pass a save point, actively save it. Because if you die and you don't have extra lives, it will go back to the last time you actually saved it. And the game actually does explain this to you. So definitely pay attention to that and just take advantage of any time you pass by a save point, save. Other instances where this mechanic is interesting. So sometimes you'll go into a dungeon and you'll get to a certain point and there are like branching paths. And so if you get to one of the screens on the dungeon, you might be able to go up, down, or right. So if you go up, you might run into a dead end or like a place where you need a key to unlock it. Or you might get to one of the branches and go on it and you get a key or you get a power up, like a new skill or something like that. But here's the thing, if you die in that entire dungeon, it's going to go back to when you last save. So sometimes what I would do is I would go into the dungeon, find the branching path, go up or down or wherever and get the key and then exit the dungeon and then save it and then go back in. Because if you go to the save point, you'll refill all of your health and stuff like that. So this is something that might seem cumbersome, but it was how I alleviated the possibility that if I die, I'd have to do it all over again, because there were one or two dungeons where I did die and not have any more lives and I had to do the whole dungeon over again. So that is a way that you can kind of go about this. Again, this can be frustrating because anytime you go off of a screen, all of those enemies will respawn the next time you go back to that screen. So it's really kind of a cost-benefit analysis. It's something that I did a couple times. I didn't do as much in the later dungeons because I felt like I could handle it, but for the first one or two, I wound up doing this, and it did kind of save me some frustration if I happened to die, because if I go to the boss and I did everything in the dungeon, but I never went back and saved, and then I died and didn't have any more lives, I would have to do the whole dungeon again. So that's something just to think about for you. Another thing with strategy is that your potions need to be refilled at the inn. They don't replenish if you go to the save point or if you die and respawn. That might help determine, like in a level or in a dungeon or at a boss fight, what you might use to heal. So sometimes I would use my mana first if I had a spell that would help me heal before I used a potion, because if I use the potion, it's not going to respawn if I die or anything like that. And then some more advanced stuff. Later in the game, you will get fast travel. You will get, like I said, these skills that allow you to traverse in different ways that act more like a key so that you can access certain things. And I will say in general, later in the game, you do have more of an arsenal. It's interesting because the early game has less diversity in terms of how you can survive, like potions or spells. There's really not a lot of spells that you find, or at least you don't have the mana to use them regularly. But it's interesting because the game, I feel like, gets harder, but you have a lot more stuff that you can use to kind of alleviate that challenge. For someone like me, who I feel like is a veteran of these 2D action-adventure games, I kind of felt like the game got easier as I got more stuff because I was ready for the platforming challenge. And then just for those who kind of geek out about games like this, again, there's a lot of side quests. There's a lot of extra content. Most of these side quests are pretty manageable. The description in them can really help you figure out where you have to go. It's not too confusing. There were a couple that I did look up because I remembered seeing something, but I didn't remember where it was. And something else is when you talk to somebody that kind of progresses your quest, you do get a notification at the top of the screen that like the quest was updated. So that's kind of telling you you're going in the right direction. You're not like, you know, missing some dialogue or something like that. The quest itself does update. And that morality system is really interesting. Again, there's a lot of hidden endgame stuff. It's something that if you're interested in, you definitely might have to play through the game a bunch of times. I don't know if you'd want to look it all up the first time, but like I said, I don't think I'm going to get the platinum trophy for this game, but it is interesting. And I do feel like games like this, people would geek out over it, much like I would with like a From Software game. So definitely if you're interested in that, dive in. All right, let's talk about the vibe of Infernax. And let's start with the visuals. So this is pixels. It is pixelated. It looks just like a Castlevania game. Less modern than Shovel Knight. I feel like Shovel Knight is very pixelated, but it kind of has big pixels and it gives a more modern feel for gestures and things like that. This game definitely does not have a modern look. That's something that may deter a lot of people. And it has a medieval setting. So you got castles, you got towns, and you get kind of drab colors like grays and browns and maybe some greens. The environments are pretty simple with some of the platforming, like you'll have flat platforms, but then you'll have like blocks, almost like you're in like Super Mario or something like that, like just singular blocks that you're jumping on. The buildings in the background are detailed, especially in towns, like the roofs and stuff like that. I didn't find too many issues with like determining with the background if something was a platform in the foreground. It can get a little confusing maybe when you start to get to like the wheels that are in the water that you have to jump on. So just be aware of that. That might be some confusion. When you perform some of the spells, that definitely adds some color pop, some of the animations there. And the enemies, so most of the enemies that you're going to come across are either like skeletons or ghost-like. There are some really cool ones, like these shadow creatures that almost look like a haunter or something like that with legs, where like their eyes and mouth kind of glow orange and the rest of their body is black and they jump around and they're kind of horrifying, but I really dig them. I think they add a nice nighttime vibe. Some of the floating creatures that do like the sine wave kind of thing, they're just eyeballs. And again, the visual hitboxes, I feel like they're very fair. Even the timing for deflecting projectiles, that is an advanced thing that you will eventually get, can be something that might take some time to get used to, but it is pretty straightforward with timing. The bosses in this game are severely grotesque. Definitely remind me a lot of the bosses in Blasphemous. They're not bad in terms of figuring out their weak spots. Often, like I said, it's an eyeball and it might be in the middle of them, or it might be two of them that are on the top and the bottom and they like alternate opening up. And the big thing in this game is there's lots and lots of gore. There's so much gore. There's lots of blood when you're killing enemies, when you're killing bosses. When you get killed, it's almost like a death screen animation, like the entire screen turns red. And then some enemies will like continue to attack you like they've just beat you to death. Almost like a survival horror, like Resident Evil type death screen animation. So it's really cool. I like that. And themes in this game, like I said, over the top with the gore, real matter of factly about it, in fact, especially in relation to like the morality choices. Like it definitely takes morality very lightly. And sometimes that can be interesting because you might choose something like, oh, this is probably the good option, and it turns out to be the bad option. But it's just like very matter-of-factly. It's just like, oh, you chose this, and now this guy's head's getting cut off or something like that. And it does it like nonchalantly right in front of you, like it doesn't wait. And there is some light fourth wall breaking, especially with some of the trophies. Like if you approach certain characters, they do certain things, or, you know, and you can kind of spam it and really mess around with them. But overall, there's just like a lot of causing chaos in general, like the morality choices, not just ones with quests, but like you can actively hit things in the game and they'll have consequences for the morality system. And you wouldn't know it for most of them unless you looked it up or unless you accidentally did it. There's one thing where I accidentally hit this wall, didn't even know it was really a wall or holding back anything, and something happened. And I was like, oh my gosh, did not expect that. But overall, the theme and the setting of the game, like I said, castle, medieval, there is some religious stuff. Like there are like monks and there is some like possession, and the story I feel like is fairly basic. It's just, you know, you're like the duke of this kingdom or this castle or whatever, and you come home and everything's kind of going crazy. But it doesn't really spend too much time on the story and the characters, which I like because I think just the world in general and the gameplay is just a nice to kind of focus on and jump into. And then in terms of audio, really love the music in this game. I think it's great music. Definitely pulls from, again, NES Zelda mixed with like Shovel Knight. It's got that 8-bit soundtrack. Some of them are high energy if you're walking through an area like in the plains or whatever and you're just killing enemies, or if it's nighttime or if you're in a cave or something like that, you know, it kind of switches to more somber and harrowing type stuff. And the sound effects are great as well. Like I said, those death sequences, if you know, you have an enemy that's like pounding you with the red screen, like you'll hear like these squishes or punches or sword stabs and stuff like that, as well as some of the spells. They have nice sound effects, nothing too over the top. And there is one sound effect in general that I love. Like anytime you kill a boss, you have to like unlock a seal and you hit it with your weapon. And then there's like this just horror, this screeching sound that's like a release of demons. It's really something that every time I do it, I'm like, whoa, that's really powerful, really strong. And so I like that sound effect. It really kind of adds to the evil nature of some of the things that are being done. All right, let's wrap up the conversation about Infernax. I really love this experience. It's a nice bite-sized adventure game. It has that NES feel. I really like the feeling of kind of open exploration and discovery, like whether you're finding different armors or different shops, like in remote places, in this kind of open world, but it's a limited open world. It's actually a very small map, but I like that it always kind of felt like I could find something anywhere. Not that it had like too many trick walls or anything like that, but it was just like, as I'm traveling through this, I'm really finding out that like, oh, there are dark corners in all of these different places where I could find things. It's definitely a manageable game, and that's something that I love about it. I never stressed about like remembering where something was. I did look at a couple small things up, but for the most part, like I said, the map is not that big, the game is not that big, but it doesn't feel like it's small. Definitely playable under 10 hours, but there's loads of extra content, side quests, and again, hidden endgame stuff that I think is really cool. I think this game has replayability because of that, not just for trophy hunting, but if you've played games that have like a quasi-binary morality system, you can play it different ways, and you can definitely do that with this game. And I think if you do that, you wind up getting a lot more extra content. So I love when games do this. Not necessarily that it's hiding a lot behind something very specific, but that you have access to it and you can find it, and it's like that hidden gem type stuff. I love the retro look, the feel, the sound, the challenge. I feel like the challenge in this game is very fair, yet I feel like there's a respectful scope and time commitment, like I talked about. In terms of value, I think $20 is good for an MSRP. I think ideally, if you find it for $15 on sale, that is the right price. After I saw it as one of the Watch Out for Fireballs episode and I didn't listen to it, I did put it on my watch list and I really did wait for it to go on sale, and I found it for $12 and I was like, I have to pull the trigger. I feel like this is going to be a certain game that I like. And so I do think that's a solid price. $15 is nice on sale. If you want to buy it full price, I think it is definitely worth it. I think for a lot of people, the look of it is going to deter them. If you're someone who is a snob about pixelated games and you think they are old or not worth your time, that might turn you away with the look of this game. But there is so much depth behind it and so much just exploration and fun and finding new spells and strategy really in how you tackle different things. And if you're somebody that loves dungeon crawlers, this is a game that will scratch that itch for you so well. So I highly, highly recommend this game. All right, that's going to wrap up this episode. Stay tuned for our next episode to see what new game we found for you.